Last time I was saying something about the sources of our information about the thought of the early Christians. And I forgot to say, what I'll now try to say very briefly, that we ought to consider also what was the source for the early Christians of their thought. It's one thing for us to say we read these books, the New Testament, and we get to know what the early Christians thought from that. But there's the other questions. Where did the early Christians get their ideas? One view would be that those that wrote the books, the New Testament, got their ideas from dictation from God. And that would account for the origin of their ideas. I suppose to many of us a more congenial view is that they got their ideas from what happened. That is, that they had certain experiences and that their ideas were derived from the experiences. Those seem to me, both of them, very conservative answers. For one thing, I don't think a religious experience comes to us with all its formulation worked out. Of course, that would be very nice if it were that way. If all that people say about religion was simply related to experience, the way a photograph is related to its object, that would be a very convenient way of deriving religious ideas. I'm afraid the real answer is a little more complicated than either of those. I'm afraid that the experience doesn't come to us with all the expression that it needs. That the expression is added to the experience, and that therefore it is subsequent to it and is derived from other factors as well as from the experience itself. And some of those other factors, of course, are the presuppositions and ideas with which the person is already loaded when the experience takes place. Take just by way of illustration this thing we're discussing, the appearance of the risen Jesus. Well, let's see. Suppose, who shall I say? Well, a friend of mine here, suppose the late T. Edmund Harvey, a well-known English friend, should appear to us alive now sometime after his death, or anybody else that died recently. What would we think? Depends on what we thought about him. Depends on what we think about life and death, about soul and body. It depends on all our religious background and all our psychological background, does it not? If you want to know what the rising of somebody from the dead would mean to that person, you've got to know what their whole view of anthropology is. Because that experience is going to produce ideas that are completely dependent on the way they think, have thought. Well, the results then of the single germ idea that Jesus had risen from the dead are the things that give it meaning, and are the meanings which are subsequently attached to the experience, or at least the conviction of the experience. Because the experience does not interpret itself alone, it doesn't come to us in a vacuum. We draw our conclusions, we think of what follows next, and so on down the line. And we're going to change our impressions as we have time to think it over. The first impression may not be the last one. We're going to talk to people about it, and they're going to talk back to us. We're going to talk to other people that share the idea, and we're going to be affected by their ideas. There's going to be an exchange of thought and a continuous evolution of thought following the initial germ thought. We are beginning in this subject then with the simple, unvarnished, and unexplained item. They believed that Jesus had risen from the dead. And so much follows from that. What follows is to the original thought about 100 to 1 in quantity, in actual quantity. I used to ask my classes many years ago to write out a list for me of the results that followed from the belief in the resurrection of Jesus. I've given that up. I didn't ask you to do it, did I? Because you would have been quite right to say everything in the New Testament follows from that. Everything. And the whole Christian movement follows from that, more or less directly. Some of it first stage, and some of the second or third stage. And therefore you have a germ idea, and it fans out until it covers everything. Well, I got tired of reading lists in which the students began writing down at random 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 different things. And I couldn't say they were wrong, because ultimately they did all go back to it. And I don't quite know what we do tonight, because I'm not sure where we'll begin and where we'll end if we try to discuss the results in the thinking. I'm talking now about ideas still, because that's what this course is on. The ideas and thoughts of the early Christians. And if this is a thought to begin with, germ thought, seed thought, that Christ had risen from the dead, well then a great many different things are going to follow. Some of these thoughts are going to be the result of not just a straight deduction, but of conflict and variety of point of view. There's some people are going to understand an event one way and some another. And before you get to if you ever get to a consensus of opinion, if I may use a crude parallel, I happened to be in England the day that the British attacked Egypt. Well, there was the first reaction, and then there were later reactions. And then I read what other people thought and talked to other people. And so it's been mulling around in my mind, and I'm not done yet. Thinking thoughts as a result of that germ idea that came to me the day I heard that England had attacked Egypt. A lot of it I heard is pretty controversial. And I'm inclined to think the early Christians ran into controversy on this point too. I'm inclined to think that their second thoughts were, well, it can't be so. First thought was wonderful, but then I wonder, is it really true? And if it's true, then this must be true. In fact, this is true because of the first. You know what I mean by the word apologetic? Not the modern use of the term, but defensive thinking. If this event happened, then to confirm your belief that it happened, you must believe certain other things too. And so we have in our New Testament a deposit, not of this initial point only, but of what they were thinking down here, or thinking over here, and thinking over here, as the whole thing fanned out. And some people thought one thing and some another. Some were interested in one deduction and some another. Some had to defend it from one point of view and some from another. And so we get the whole series. I've got some questions down here that may illustrate that. Why does Paul mention the burial? You remember how brief Paul's account is. He was buried. Why does Paul mention that? Why does Mark mention it?
As evidence that he was dead.
What say?
As evidence that he was dead.
Prove he was dead, yeah. All right. First thing you would say if somebody you thought was dead turned up alive, was he really dead? Well, he's as dead as people are when they're buried. I have to say that. Of course, that even isn't conclusive. There are plenty of skeptics would say, even though he was buried, he must have wriggled out somehow. And you have a tomb where you could wriggle out if you knew how to do it, had the combination, you could get out somehow. Why does Mark mention the women at the burial? You say perfectly natural. When a beloved one dies, the women are all anxious to do what they can and follow the corpse to its final resting place. And the reason he mentioned is that it happened, and it naturally happened. And I wouldn't be the first to admit that it might very well happen, but is that the reason Mark mentions it? Or does Mark mention it because somebody may have said, are you dead sure of the tomb? And are you sure the people that saw the empty tomb got the right tomb? You'll observe that the women that saw the burial are pretty much the same ones that came to the empty tomb. By having them at both points, you are operating, though he doesn't say why he's doing it, you can see that tradition would want to build up this identity of witnesses at both the burial and the empty tomb. Why does John tell the story about the print of the nails? Isn't that pretty plainly told? Because people wanted to identify the body as the same body. There wouldn't be an awful lot of people in Jerusalem that Sunday morning, would there, with a wound just here and nail prints there. You know how they identify corpses by the use of certain holes in the fillings in the teeth? Well, if you want to be sure who this is, and that you're really seeing the person that was hanged, that would be a reason. Why does Luke represent Jesus, the risen Jesus, as eating? Just gratuitous bit of irrelevant information? Or did the ancient world believe that disembodied spirits didn't have to eat. I don't want to make you jealous of disembodied spirits. It must be most convenient. But wouldn't that explain? Any of you ever read the book of Tobit? You may remember there is a spirit in the book of Tobit, an angel. And the angel reminds his companion, after traveling right across the Euphrates and back again, that all the time, he says, that I've been with you, you didn't see me eat a thing. The angel's now confessing to his companion that he is an angel. And he's reminding his companion that this evidence is the kind of evidence you have when you're dealing with an angel. But if you're not dealing with an angel, but dealing with a real live person, then the evidence is on the other foot, the other way around. And so we read in Luke, do we not, that they gave him a piece of bread and a honeycomb, and that he ate? And don't we read it one or two other passages in Luke's writings where he's represented as eating with the disciples?